Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Could cap-and-trade systems save the world from the ravages of climate change or lull us into a perilously diluted sense of security? If energy legislation pending in the U.S. Congress makes it into law, demand for carbon credits is expected to reach an all-time high. But what exactly will buyers be paying for? And how do we know we can trust the people tasked with holding sellers accountable for their intangible savings of carbon emissions? Mark Shapiro is senior correspondent at the Center for Investigative Reporting in Berkeley, California. He examines the issue in a February cover story for Harper's Magazine called Conning the Climate, Inside the Carbon Trading Shell Game. Mark, welcome to Think.
Thank you. Good to be here.
So cap and trade works beautifully on paper, but as you point out, it's based on the lack of delivery of an invisible substance to no one, and therefore it starts to break down very quickly when it's applied in the real world.
Yes, you described that beautifully, although I suppose I described it.
You described it beautifully.
Beautiful to hear the quote coming back to me. Yes, you know, I think what people have to basically be ready to do is take kind of a bit of a leap into the abstract when they think of cap and trade. So so basically you have a system cap and trade with this idea that's now being debated in the US Congress and that already exists in much of the world, which is that the government would impose caps on greenhouse gas emissions, and then in order for companies to reach, if they go over those caps, they can actually go purchase an emission reduction somewhere else that enables them to keep polluting essentially at home. So the and what they would be purchasing in this other place is a carbon credit. And that credit, that market in these things called carbon credits, which is essentially an offset of somebody else's emissions, is now a $300 billion market, a huge market for these things. And so, of course, what I wrote about was how you measure this commodity, because what these carbon commodities actually are a promise to reduce emissions in the future.
Let's talk about the kinds of companies, first of all, that would be regulated under cap and trade, and then the entities that are producing these credits in the first place. A lot of them are in the developing world.
Right, exactly. So now we have two different systems, basically. We have the global system. You remember going way back to 1997. I know that seems like another era right now, but in that year, of course, the Kyoto Protocol was signed, and basically committing the world to fighting the emissions of greenhouse gases.
And we put a lot of that together before we pulled out.
Well, we did. That's what's funny. And the United States actually came in at that time, and much of the world actually wanted this idea of a carbon tax. That a price be put on carbon. And the United States came back and said, hold on here, we don't like taxes. We want to do this market mechanism, which is now called cap and trade, industries are issued limits on their emissions, and then like I explained, they can then go purchase offsets somewhere else to meet those limits. So that system, largely designed by the United States. The United States, of course, pulled out in 2001, excuse me, and the rest of the world was left to execute basically this kind of American idea. And so now here we have 13 years after Kyoto, an enormous market in these things called carbon offsets, which the United States is essentially preparing to engage with once we pass our own system. So the United States does not yet have a system of emission limits, is what's being debated right now in the Congress. I think many Americans perhaps aren't aware that we actually have no emission limits at this stage. But that's being debated right now in the Congress, which would essentially put us on the same level as other developed countries.
And this is already the fastest growing commodities market in the world. What sort of bump would there be if the U.S. did, in fact, institute a broad spectrum cap and trade system?
Well, good question. So you've already got this cap-and-trade system, a carbon market operating in all the countries that signed and ratified Kyoto. So that means basically all of Europe, 27 countries in Europe, other countries like Norway, Japan, New Zealand, all developed countries, essentially, other than the United States, they are now deeply enmeshed in this market, which is now a $200 to $300 billion market. Billion. I mean, this is a huge market. And now, when the United States establishes our own system, that market is expected to quintuple, basically, up to around $1 to $2 trillion are the estimates as of 2020. So we're talking about essentially an enormous leap into a whole new economic universe, really.
I mean, what happens to the supply in that situation?
Well, the supply, this is what I write about in Harper's, because what's critical here is if you have this market, you know, let's imagine this, we're talking about a $1 trillion market once the United States signs on to this program. What you're buying and selling, let's remember what it is we're buying and selling. What we're buying and selling in the carbon market is literally a promise not to produce one ton of carbon dioxide. So literally, if you yourself or your listeners were to actually go on the market, if we would fly over to London for a day and start speculating on the carbon market, they would literally be buying one ton units of carbon. We say carbon. It's called carbon. If you look at it in the business pages, you will see carbon. There's actually a price for carbon right now. It's going for about between $20 and $25 a ton in London. But what is that? When we say carbon, it's actually the disappearance of carbon that we're buying. It's actually the promise to make that one ton of carbon disappear. And this is what this promise, this idea that an emission would somehow not happen, is now essentially one of the central mechanisms that the world is using to fight climate change and greenhouse gases.
So, Mark, what is required for a company to make that promise? What sorts of conditions do they have to meet in order to be considered to sell their credits?
Yes. So imagine you've got this new economic universe that I've described. And then what this has given rise to is a whole phenomenon of now you have carbon brokers who are traveling around the world looking for these kind of projects that could be conjured into commodities and then sold to major industrial firms. So in order to obtain, to create this commodity, you basically need to get it approved by the United Nations. And to get it approved by the United Nations, you have to demonstrate a number of things. You have to demonstrate. So let's say, for example, let me give you an example of some things I've seen. So, for example, you've got a pig farm in Brazil. And this pig farm, we all know that pigs, the waste product of pigs, out comes methane. Huge releasers of methane. Methane is a very potent greenhouse gas. So you've got one of these massive pig farms in Brazil, and then a company comes along and says, all right, look, if you apply this particular machine, this particular device, to capture the methane as it's coming off the pig lot, then you will be able to reduce your emissions by, you know, X amount over the next 4 or 5 years, reduce your emissions of methane. So I'm the pig guy. I'm down there in Brazil. I'm the pig guy. And I then go to a carbon broker who then packages my proposal to say basically, all right, I'll reduce these emissions over time if I get this machine. But you have to get me the money so I can buy the machine. And then that carbon broker then presents that proposal to what's called a validator. A validator then essentially validates the emission reduction promise claims. They look at the analysis, they look at the numbers, and they say, okay, well, this looks legitimate or this does not look legitimate, and then passes it on to the United Nations. The United Nations ultimately approves the project, which then, with the United Nations approval, it becomes a commodity. So we have to actually understand for the first time, I think it's a new idea to get used to, is that the United Nations is the oversight body for this massive new commodity. Carbon.
And what? So, yeah. Go ahead.
And it's the United Nations stamp of approval, which enables an industry in a developed country purchase an offset in a developing country.
So we'll talk more in a minute about it. It starts to get squirrely in the validation process, as well as some other steps along the way. But it also, one of the other requirements is that you have to be unusual in your field. If you're that pig farmer, if every other pig farmer around you is already doing this, you don't get to sell those credits because it's industry standard. It almost seems that there's somewhat of a perverse incentive there, because as more and more people start to do this, you lose your supply.
Yes, that's actually a very good point. Yes. what you've identified is one of the things you have to prove in order to become this new commodity, to become your new this new carbon commodity, is that without the money, the certification from the United Nations, which enables the money to flow to your project, you would never be able to pursue this new alternative technology. So you have to be able to prove, for example, like you just suggested, you have to be able to prove that that other companies all around you, your competitors, are essentially not doing the same thing, which if they were doing the same thing, it would make economic sense without this extra amount of money. I mean, in a way, what you have to prove, which makes it so difficult, is that what you're doing does not make economic sense. And that's one thing you have to do. The second thing is you need to demonstrate that there's no law requiring you to do it, because if there was a law, then you'd be doing it anyway. And critically, what this idea is, it's a whole new word to describe this this process, and it's a brand new word that's entered into the lexicon called additionality. And what that means is that the money approved by the United Nations enables something to happen, an emission reduction plan to happen, that otherwise would never happen without that money. And that is what's called additionality. And there's an enormous, there's a high degree of subjectivity. And what I write about in Harper's essentially the difficulties in measuring additionality.
Let's talk about how all of this is validated. So you put this machine in place and you start to reduce the methane emissions from your pig farm, and then somebody comes back who has been certified by the UN and says, yes, it's happening, or no, it's not?
Yes. So you're the pig farmer, and you've got this kind of idea for a new methane capture device. There are about 20 firms that the United Nations has certified as being what they call validators. These are companies that basically do the carbon accounting. So imagine you've got in Wall Street, for example, you've got Moody's and Standard & Poor's and the companies that essentially stamp and affirm the value of a company, which enables an investor to make an informed decision about the value of that company. I mean, we've also seen problems with those assertions, but, you know, let's put those aside for the moment. So basically, you've got the Moody's and Standard & Poor's for the companies, publicly traded companies. So in that world, in the carbon world, you've got a very similar idea. They're called validators. And what they do is they actually come in and they validate the claims by the pig farm, in this case, that they will actually be reducing the emissions to the extent that they promise over the next 5 years. What they are essentially doing is they say, okay, you promise over the next 5 years to reduce your emissions by, you know, 20 million tons. Well, we're going to look at the analysis and try to figure out if you're actually telling the truth. Is it going to be more like 10 million tons? Are you is this BS, or does it hold up according to our analysis? And so these companies, they're called validators, essentially put their stamp of validation on the proposal when it goes to the United Nations.
Mark Shapiro, let's take a quick break. Mark Shapiro is my guest. He's senior correspondent at the Center for Investigative Reporting. We're speaking about his cover story for Harper's Magazine this month called Conning the Climate, Inside the Carbon Trading Shell Game. Join us now by calling 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. Hundreds of non-credit personal enrichment and professional development courses begin this spring. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Mark Shapiro. He is senior correspondent at the Center for Investigative Reporting, and he's written a cover story for Harper's Magazine this month called Conning the Climate, Inside the Carbon Trading Shell Game. You can join our conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372 or by sending email to think@kera.org. So, Mark, we're with you so far. You have these promises made to reduce emissions. You have validators who come in and measure to see if it's happened. But now what happens if the carbon savings or the methane savings are not what was promised? Because the bulk of that money, if not all of it, has already been spent putting those machines in place or doing something with it.
Yes. I mean, that is the central question. You've got something that has two purposes. One is to function as a market, which it seems to be doing pretty well. And the second is to essentially use the leverage created by those market forces to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. And so what happens is if it turns out that, so for example, what I found in the, what I reported on the in my article and my research is essentially that the promises of emission reductions have been considerably exaggerated, and that number one, many of analysts who've gone back in to actually see how many emission reductions we're getting from these things have identified serious overstatements in the promises. So, in essence, that if you're spending $1 on your emission offset, you may, if you're lucky, be getting maybe 65 to 70 cents worth of emission reduction in many of the projects that are in this system. So while a huge amount of money is moving into the system, the question is how many actually emission reductions are we actually getting? And so the answer to your question is the liability issues as to what happens if we don't get those emissions that were promised. Is a question that is still very much being settled in this market. What I found in my reporting was that two of the biggest, so there are about let's say a dozen of the biggest these big global accounting firms that do the accounting on the carbon offsets, and what I found was that. Two of the biggest, the two biggest of those accounting firms, one is a Swiss company, the other is a Norwegian company, because remember, this is an international business, were suspended by the United Nations when the United Nations determined that the adequacy of its reviews the companies did not have the adequate skill level of people who were doing these assessments, that their analyses were filled with erroneous calculations, and found a whole array of problems in the audits that were done by these two companies. And each one was then taken off, suspended from its ability to do these kind of audits.
And it's worth noting here that one of the suspended firms was the one that set the protocols for measuring these things.
Exactly. One of the companies essentially was the one that created, it's called DNV. Created the whole methodological approach for assessing how to measure these emission reductions. So now both of those companies, one's called DNV, the other's called SGS, you can read about in my article, both of those companies have since been reinstated by the United Nations after they cleaned up their accounting procedures. But keep in mind that up until the point of their suspension, both of those companies combined are responsible for more than half of the emission reduction claims that are now being traded on the market. So you have hundreds of millions of dollars passing back and forth in this global market based on emission reduction claims that were certified by two of the biggest companies whose calculations were called into question. So one of the points that I discuss in the article is what that means for the integrity of the whole trading process, because the UN essentially does not have the power to revoke or to bring back emission carbon emission a commodity once, even if there's found to be flawed measuring involved in how they were assessed. So these measures, you know, not unlike other commodities that we've seen moving in a troubling way through the economy, are still very much being traded, and yet the value that they bring to the climate, which is ultimately the reason for this, is questionable.
So it's essentially like you buy a car that turns out to be a lemon, and there's no mechanism whatsoever for taking it back to the dealership or for punishing the dealership.
Yes, that's basically the only punishment there is. Essentially, is in this case they were suspended, each of them for about 3 or 4. One was 3 months, the other was 4 months, and then they were brought back into the fold. But there is no mechanism for taking back, like you said, the lemons that had been certified in the several years previous to that. And in fact, there had been a discussion, even the U.S. delegation, I spoke to some people in the U.S. delegation back during the Kyoto Protocol, is they knew that this could be a problem, you know, if you end up with a flawed audit. And so the emission limits reductions you think you're getting, you're not actually getting. And the Kyoto negotiators decided at that time not to give the United Nations the power to revoke these credits, because they wanted to get companies involved in this market and lure new investment capital into the market, and they thought that would create too much risk.
Since we're essentially selling nothing to no one in these cases, what is the risk that these credits are double sold?
Well, that's a very good question. I mean, in the early days, I think that the two answers to your question. Number one, in the early days of this market, I think there were numerous instances where credits were oversold or were double sold, meaning, you know, you've got a pocket of air in Brazil and you could sell it to multiple companies who are basically buying what they think is the same offset. I think that basically that's one thing I think the United Nations really has tightened up on, and I think there's fairly rigorous controls to ensure that that kind of double selling doesn't occur. Now, that said, in the United States, you have a voluntary market, which is where carbon is bought and sold here. People are probably aware of the possibility of offsetting their carbon footprint, and they can go buy a carbon offset somewhere under purely voluntary rules. There's no government rules at all in the United States. And this phenomenon of double counting is far more prevalent, I think, now in the United States market, actually, than it is in the global market, which is a different question from the measuring of how much the emission reductions there actually are.
Mark Shapiro is my guest. He's senior correspondent at the Center for Investigative Reporting. His Harper's Magazine cover story is called Conning the Climate Inside the Carbon Trading Shell Game. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. Let's go first on the line to Will in Dallas. Hi, Will.
Hi. Yeah, I understand the sell side of this, but I don't really understand the buy side. What's in it for the person buying the commodity? And I'll take my question off air, but I don't understand where they're making their money.
Thanks for your call.
Thanks.
Oh. Well, that is a totally great question. Right. The buy side, there are two people that buy these things. Number one, that's companies which need emission credits by them because they have to go spend, you know, they've got a limit of 100 million tons of emissions, and they emit 120 million tons, and so they've got to go find somewhere out there in the world 20 million tons to bring them in under their limits. So they're the ones buying, and then at the same time you have speculators. So there's been a lot of volatility in the carbon price. The carbon price really rotates somewhere between $15 to $25 a ton globally. And so if you're a trader, you trade that on that carbon price very much like an oil trader trades on the oil price. It's the same kind of mechanism. You're essentially betting on the price. So you're betting on the price that this commodity will have. There are whole derivative bundles now being made out of carbon, which, of course, is a bet, essentially is a speculation on the price. And in fact, you know, the major financial houses here in the United States have all set up carbon trading desks in London. And I think most, I mean, if you want any sign of how much money can be made in this market, just look at who's in the market now. And that is, you know, Merrill Lynch has a major carbon trading operation, J.P. Morgan, Citibank, and other major financial houses, American financial houses, have substantial trading desks in London because you can make money off the spread in that price.
So where is the base price? I understand supply and demand, but how did we arrive at what it is now? It's at $22, $23 per ton. What goes into that?
Okay, well, you have to get your head around this to begin with. get your head around the idea that carbon is essentially, in a way, carbon is infinite. I mean, it's all out there. We're all, in fact, all of us are kind of breathing carbon dioxide, as you know, while we're hopefully inhaling oxygen. So the carbon dioxide out there is potentially infinite. So this is a commodity that essentially is defined by the government, which establishes these limits. So if a government essentially says, in a Kyoto country, in England, for example, and I don't know the exact numbers, but let's say that in England the number that all of England is allowed to emit is, let's say, 500 billion tons of carbon dioxide comes out of the United Kingdom each year, let's say. So then the United Kingdom basically says, all right, well, you cement maker, you steel maker, you chemical manufacturer, you're only allowed to emit a certain amount of carbon. And then the price mechanism comes from a combination of how tight those caps are, so how many tons of offset, how many tons do people have to buy, essentially, and how much of these offsets are available. Because you know, theoretically, I mean, what the United Nations does, and the European Union also has its own system, is establish a criteria for measuring, essentially, these reduction promises. And so there is a supply-demand, but the supply is the demand is established by the government cap, right, by the cap put on the emissions, and the supply is created by the number of these kind of offset projects that are created in the world. And this is how it works. It's actually a commodity largely defined by the commitment of government to reduce greenhouse gas emissions.
Can this also be applied to new businesses or new companies coming online? If, for example, I just have a piece of land and I didn't have a pig farm before, but I decide to start one, can I apply for carbon to trade my carbon offset if I put that machine in place?
Well, you know, what you have in the United States is you have a huge, bill, Kerry-Boxer bill, and the bills that are now in the U.S. Congress, and those bills allow for an array of offsets within the United States, even. So you might actually be able to get a credit for like your pig farm in Texas. For saying that, if you didn't get this money from an offset, you were going to just do a traditional old pig farm and all that methane is going to go into the atmosphere. But if you go to in this case, it would probably be the USDA, and you say, hold on here, I want to install this new machine, you could, under the American system, probably get offset credits. And this is, yes. So the answer is yes. And right now, actually, one of the things you see in the U.S. Congress is a whole series of lobbying kind of trade-offs going on, it hasn't been the most friendly Congress yet or it's been largely a partisan breakdown on the cap and trade legislation.
Yeah.
And to try to get support, you have many, many new kind of offset projects being thrown into the mix to attract senators and congresspeople from different states. So you have there are a lot of offsets, for example, around pigs and around kind of no-till farming and other kinds of plans to bring in agricultural senators also.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phones now to Raul in Dallas. Hey, Raul.
How do you do?
Very well, thank you.
Yes, I've been wanting to find out who it is that I can contact about selling my reduction of carbon emissions. I have developed a device that I have installed in tractor trailers and cars, and I have a study done whereby I reduce 99.5% of hydrocarbon emissions and nitrous oxides, et cetera, et cetera. But if I am saving that much, or my device saves that much on a tractor trailer, I am the one that is creating the reduction. My machine is the one that is creating the reduction in carbon. Who do I talk to about selling the carbons that are no longer emitted at the tailpipe of a car or a truck?
Well, Raul, I appreciate your call. Without asking Mark to give you specific business advice, maybe you can speak in a general way to what somebody would do who had an innovation like this.
I think if you've got a device like that, essentially, I would say this whole market system that we're talking about here is partly intended to spur innovations like the one this gentleman is describing, and to send private capital moving in that direction rather than a tax. Although in a way they both end up costing money.
Yeah.
But from your point of view, essentially the person would get a credit from the person who would obtain your technology. Let's say it actually does what you think it does. Sounds interesting. Then the person who used it will say, well, maybe your machine, I don't know how much it costs, $500 or $1,000 or $10,000, but I need that extra $10,000 to use this man's machine on my delivery truck or whatever it is, although I don't think that would be a credit yet,
Let me have you stop right there. We're going to take another quick break. Mark Shapiro is with us. We're talking about his Harper's Magazine February cover story. Join us at 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. Hundreds of non-credit personal enrichment and professional development courses begin this spring. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Mark Shapiro. He is senior correspondent at the Center for Investigative Reporting and has written the cover story for Harper's Magazine this month. It's called Conning the Climate, Inside the Carbon Trading Shell Game. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also get to us via email to think@kera.org. So just to wrap up Raul's question from the last segment, Mark, essentially it wouldn't be the inventor of this technology. It would be the people to whom he sold it that could potentially sell credits, but that would affect the amount of money he's able to charge for such a product.
Right, exactly. Okay. And he could sort of offer that in his, you know, investment perspectives to investors, saying, you know, a part of my potential market would be people who would be spurred into buying my technology by this kind of new carbon market.
I want to go to what? Oh, go ahead.
And people like him, I think, if they're, you know, would theoretically, under this kind of green stimulus program and all that, there are probably other ways to get stimulus money, but I don't quite know what they are. But that would be different.
Yeah.
It's the person who uses the technology.
One other issue here is that, so you have these validators who can, I suppose, make a decent living testing all of this and measuring, and we'll assume here, for the sake of argument, that they are honest and doing their best work. But they can make a lot more money if they switch over and start developing these projects as opposed to just coming in and making sure that they are on the up and up.
Yes, I mean, that's one of the things I looked at obviously to the integrity of these kind of measurements, you need a third party verification, meaning companies that are independent and can look at things without an interest in the result, obviously. And what you find, and in this system, is a very quickly spinning revolving door, where people from the validation companies cut their teeth in the business doing the validations, and then they go to work for project developers, which develop the projects and then bring them back to the validators. And so there's this completely revolving door between the people who are developing the projects and the people who are auditing the projects. And this has been, there's also a phenomenon where the person who develops a project, so for example, the pig farm person that we keep talking about, who actually does exist out there in Brazil, and I'm sure exists in Texas and elsewhere, but let's say this pig farm person has this idea for reducing the methane. That project developer pays for their own audits. So what you have is actually an enormous amount of competition from the auditing companies to get the business to do these validations. And some people I've talked to said that creates a lot of concern as to people, you know, are basically bidding on contracts to do audits. Are they promising certain results? There's been a lot of analysis done of these reports that show a lot of kind of inadequate oversight. And so there have been efforts to crack down on these areas of conflicts of interest, number one, having the project developers pay for their own audits and have competition among different firms to get the business, and two, this revolving door. But it turns out that the validators have a very strong lobby in at the United Nations, and have thus far sort of beaten back those efforts.
Let's go back to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372 and speak with Lane in Dallas. Hi, Lane.
Hi. I just had a question. I'm trying to figure out, and maybe this is answered in the article I need to read, but it doesn't sound like if I'm a polluter, there's any check on me creating more pollution. If I was a, let's say I had a coal plant here in Texas, a power plant, and I'm emitting all this carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, and I get 100 credits, let's say, from the government to, you know, that's how many I'm allowed to use. I get that. And these people are measuring how much I'm polluting. I mean, do they just have something attached to my smokestack where it measures it all year, and if I go over, you know, the 100 credits, I have to pay a fine, or I have to buy the more credits, and what if there aren't any more to buy? I guess I just, any way I think about it, I don't see how there's not some way to just pollute as much as you want. I maybe you can answer that, maybe you can't.
Thanks for your call.
That's a very it's a very good question, because it actually strikes at the heart of this market mechanism. So, for example, if you are a coal-fired power plant, of which I know you have several in Texas, yes, the answer in a cap-and-trade system, you would basically have the EPA, in this case, would be monitoring your emissions. Now, the EPA already does that. This is nothing new that emissions are monitored in the United States at all. Starting the Clean Air Act 20 years ago, basically started the process of reducing certain particulates and ozone and all sorts of smog in the air, which is why our air is somewhat cleaner than it was 20 years ago. So the idea of monitoring emissions is not in itself anything new at all. What is new is monitoring the particular greenhouse gas component of those emissions. And that is what, of course, is being debated now in Congress. And so in answer to your question number one, emissions, yes, in major coal-fired power plants would be the greenhouse gas component to the emissions that are already being monitored. There would be a new element added to the already existing monitoring, and that would be greenhouse gases. You would get a number. That number is obviously hotly debated right now, but your number would be, let's say, 100 million tons. And you, meaning you, sir, the owner of the power plant, I'm sure, would essentially be given this 100 million ton limit. You, however, emit 120 million tons. So why it costs you money, and this is the theory behind it, is that it does cost you money, because you have to then go out and find this 20 million tons worth of credits over time. And the theory behind cap and trade is essentially that the that now your emission limit might be 100 million tons. You have to find 20 million tons worth. Well, then 5 years from now, your limit might be 80 million tons. You have to go then find 40 million tons worth of offset credits, and so on. And the cap keeps going down, and the expense of those offsets keeps going up. And as that happens, it becomes more a higher incentive for you to invest in renewable energy technology than it costs you to go find these offsets. And that is essentially what the basic presumption is of cap and trade, is that it enables companies to have an option of either installing renewable energy technology or finding an offset somewhere else in the world. And those offsets are considerably less expensive, up to 50 to 80% less expensive than actually installing that renewable energy technology.
Is there evidence that it's working that way in Europe?
Well, that is the thing. Does this work? And I think that there is some evidence that there have been some levels of emission reductions in Europe as a result of this market mechanism. Really very small number, but some emission reductions have resulted. And my question really is, because this elaborate system obviously is very expensive, and it's extremely complicated. It's filled with enormous amount of trap doors and possibilities for gaming the system or for essentially overestimation of the emission reductions you think you're getting. And so my question is more, we think by installing this kind of system based on the global model that already exists, that we're going to be reducing emissions by a certain amount. Look, science, if we accept the arguments, which I do and most scientists do, tell us that, you know, we've got to keep the emission reductions down no more than 2 degrees by 2050, or we're going to have really catastrophic effects on the planet. So that's what this whole debate is happening against that background. And so if we take that seriously and we're going to implement a kind of a market approach like this is, excuse me, then we need to understand that those emission reductions on the other end, that this whole market system is intended to facilitate, are actually the emission reductions we think we're getting. Because otherwise we're spending, otherwise it can be an extremely inefficient means of reducing greenhouse gas emissions while at the same time making some people very wealthy, meaning traders and stuff like that who are the speculators in the market. And so I think one of the interesting things when you look at it is that the whole system was devised largely by the United States in the late 90s at Kyoto, basically to avoid this idea of a carbon tax. And none of us like the idea of a tax. I don't like it. I don't like taxes any more than you do, or I'm sure anybody does, actually. But the fact is, if this system, if it had the levels of oversight and the levels of intrusion, I think this is one of the great ironies, is that if it had the level of oversight and the levels of guarantees that the emission reductions promised or the emission reductions delivered, you would end up, you know, with a substantial oversight operation, which could, in the end, amount to essentially a carbon tax, which is, I think, one of the great ironies. In other words, if you had a fully functioning system with all the checks that you need to make sure you're getting those emission reductions, in a way, you'd have to then compare that against an actual tax. This whole system is devised to avoid a tax.
Let's check in on the phones now with John in Dallas. Hi, John.
Yes, hi. I understand that a simple tax on carbon is probably the most effective way and efficient way to go, but it doesn't seem like that's really politically feasible or realistic in America today in this political environment. But wasn't it a similar sort of cap-and-trade system that was used in the Midwest and Northeast to mitigate the acid rain, and I understand that that was fairly successful. The other part of my question is, you know, if we implement a cap-and-trade system and it's full of all these flaws, wouldn't we expect to modify the system over time, similar to the way the Europeans have done with theirs? I mean, their initial cap-and-trade system, I understand they issued too many credits or they gave them away for free, and they were full of problems, but that it has improved over time. And I'm just wondering, wouldn't it be reasonable to expect the same sort of outcome here?
Boy, these are great. Yes. The answer, let's start with your last part of your question. The I think that as the market matures, there is the potential for beginning to get some kind of percentage of the emission reductions that you think you're getting will increase over time. And I think that's happened in the European system and theoretically could happen in the American system. If you look at the American system, some areas of many people are concerned about are a whole array of kind of offsets that are completely distinct from the European system. There's a whole number of different things that would be permitted in America that would not be permitted elsewhere in the world because of their difficulty in measurements and how you measure, for example, no-till farming. How do you provide a standardized and predictable measurement system for how much carbon is avoided? And there are several other examples kind of like that. And so the measurement challenge is made more acute by the particular nature of the American legislation going through, number one. And two, I think that in a way, your point is actually very well taken that the European system has gotten incrementally better. I think it's gotten more substantial, and I think there's it's more tightly overseen than it was some years ago. And but that's taken an enormous amount of regulatory oversight, and still a lot of holes in it. And my point, because it actually makes me uncomfortable too, because I write about environmental matters. I've been doing it for years.
We got about 15 seconds, Mark.
Okay. It's just as we move forward on these questions, it's not to say this doesn't work, that doesn't work. It's just know what we're getting into in passing this cap-and-trade system and the particular challenges that it presents.
Mark Shapiro is senior correspondent at the Center for Investigative Reporting in Berkeley, California. His February cover story for Harper's is called Conning the Climate, Inside the Carbon Trading Shell Game. Mark, it's been a fascinating hour. Thank you so much for spending it with us.
Well, thank you.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.